Hello, everyone. I wouldn't for a moment say that I was lent upon to organise Members' Day 2006. However, after I volunteered, I began to discover just what I'd taken on. I suggested, and indeed secured agreement, to the topic of the philosophy of language for two main reasons. I was fortunate enough to find three excellent speakers who were willing to talk on the subject. And although we've nibbled at the philosophy of language in recent seminars, we never really taken it on as a whole. And I began to discover why. First, Marianne said to me, innocently enough, I thought, "Oh, that's fine, that subject, as long as it's the philosophy of language and not linguistic philosophy." Well, I spent about a couple of hours trying to discover what the difference was between these. I did find that most of the pioneers of the philosophy of language were tainted with the linguistic brush. Ouch. And I also thought then, well, Peter's going to be talking on Wittgenstein, and Alan was tutored by that arch linguist, J.O. Austin. And I'm just hoping to avoid Marianne's wrath. Maybe she was thinking, though, more about the likes of Derrida and Saussure, in which case, important and fascinating philosophers though they were, I'm safe, because they're not going to figure a great deal, or I think you're going to mention Saussure, aren't you, Lisa? Oh. I also discovered the daunting extent of the field of the philosophy of language, which covers truth and meaning, reference and descriptions, naming, propositional attitudes, metaphor, interpretation and translation, and so on and so on. And the philosophy of language is deeply implicated in epistemology, in metaphysics, in the philosophy of mind. The scope is just huge, and the team can't hope to do more than scratch the surface of that. Well, what I hope we can do is provide some informative and fascinating material which will give scope for lively and controversial discussion. I'll be kicking off with what is really a mapping of the territory, sketch map of the field, making some connections between major landmarks. Alan will give an evaluation and a defence of language as a vital area for philosophical investigation. And Peter will talk about his and my beloved Wittgenstein, and particularly that tricky area known as the autonomy of language. Nigel's mentioned that we unfortunately lost Patrick Butterley to illness, and with him a talk on metaphor, which would have been superb, something that Nietzsche called the essence of language. Anyway, that will do. I'll now plunge into my talk on the development of the philosophy of language, of which you should all have a summary in the handouts. Philosophy of language goes back at least to Plato. His theory of ideas gave an account of how an individual word is related to a multiplicity of particular things. And taking a large jump, Hobbes, Locke, Herder, and Mill all developed theories in the philosophy of language. But apart from a few initial words on Locke, my starting point is going to be Frege's The Foundations of Arithmetic, published in 1884. The reason is that I've decided to structure my talk in relation to four terms, T-U-R-N-S, pivotal points in the philosophy of language, to which the direction changed in reaction to or as a development of a preceding view or fashion. And the first of these terms is the linguistic term, which Alan and I, with Michael Dummett, would probably consider the launching pad for analytic philosophy. The other three terms are the pragmatic term, the interpretive term, and my own coinage, the sociological term. Each of these led to new theories of meaning or truth or communication in words and new ways of regarding language. Frege's linguistic turn was away from the mentalism that had characterized most philosophy till then. This mentalism, which Frege called psychologism, prioritise not just thought over language, but men's minds as the repository of thought and meaning. Mind, Descartes' res cogitans, and thoughts were very much in the head, and concepts were psychological, mental concepts. This can clearly be seen in Locke's theory of language. Words for Locke only labelled things in the outside world indirectly. In fact, they labelled ideas in the head, albeit planted there by sense impressions. As he put it, words are sensible signs necessary for communication of ideas. Man, though he have a great variety of thoughts, and such from which others as well as himself might receive profit and delight, yet they are all within his own breast, invisible and hidden from others. Words for him could also label concepts and general ideas, but these were complexes of, or abstracts from, simple mental ideas. There are three consequences of this theory that are worth mentioning. First, the consequence for communication. But since words represent exclusively ideas in the speaker's head, it's only through, in Locke's words, long and familiar use that words can come to excite in men certain ideas so constantly and readily that they are apt to suppose a natural connection between them. Secondly, and as a consequence of this, mistakes can be made leading to failures of communication, so that, in Locke's words again, no one hath the power to make others have the same ideas in their minds that he has when they use the same words as he does. We shall see that Quine and Wittgenstein had other ways of explaining the indeterminacy of language. And thirdly, although Locke's theory of truth allowed propositions a truth value, ideas, even the complex ones, being but bundles of simple ideas, could only be true or false insofar as they were or were not in conformity with other people's private ideas expressed in words. The linguistic term, affected by Frege, in parallel to Husserl, incidentally, was to liberate thoughts expressible in words from the closet of the mind, arguably giving priority to language over thought. Arguably, because though it's difficult to see how complicated thoughts can occur prior to the language in which they're expressed, Frege could still write to Husserl in 1906, "The main task of the logician consists in liberation from language." And despite turning his back firmly on what he called psychologism, he retained the concept of a private idea in men's minds that was distinct from, but closely related to, the meaning of a word or sentence. Dummett cites the first clear example of Frege's linguistic turn as when he raises the Kantian question, "How are numbers given to us, granted that we have no idea or intuition of them?" Frege answers this in terms of his context principle, that it's only in the context of a sentence that a word has meaning, a principle that Frege explicitly formulated as governing an inquiry into language, not as governing an inquiry into thought, as was open to him. If we agree with Dummett, the twin axioms of analytical philosophy are: one, that a philosophical account of thought can be attained through a philosophical account of language, and two, that a comprehensive account can be only so attained. To Frege, sentences express thoughts, and by giving thoughts linguistic form, he liberated meaning from the privacy of men's minds and to the freedom of public sentences with a semantic content. By thus showing that public language was the key to unlocking the thoughts it expressed, Frege effected the linguistic turn towards the study of language as crucial to philosophical endeavour, and on these grounds has been dubbed the grandfather of analytic philosophy. In the process, he made major contributions to the philosophy of language itself. I refer to the meaning of a word or sentence, and of course, theories of meaning constitute an important part of the philosophy of language. Frege inherited, with all its shortcomings, the designative or referential tradition, whereby words' meanings are equated with the things they refer to. Words were signs representing things. Straightforwardly, things in the world, for Augustine, mediated by mental ideas, for Locke, and Mill treated proper names, at least, as labels for their owners. Frege and Russell, too, and to an extent Quine and Davidson, all stuck to the designative tradition, while at the same time vastly improving and enriching it. But before indicating the kinds of improvements they made, I'd like to contrast designative theories with two other types of meaning theory, all three best understood by reference to a model that relates language to the three zones it appears to touch and somehow interconnect. These are the world, the utterer, and the audience. Language is a medium for communication, and communication is essentially between an utterer and his audience, and is generally about the world. In the words of Jose Medina, whom I've lent on quite heavily in preparing this talk, language is a medium that serves simultaneously three different but internally related functions. So meaning theories can be roughly divided into three groups, each of which gives prominence to one or other of these relata. I know Alan, in his talk, will come back to this, and like him, I'm relying on distinctions made by Habermas on the basis of this tripartite structure, which is owed to Bühler. Habermas points out that theories giving prominence to the utterer or speaker concentrate on the expressive function of language, and their validity claims tend to rest on subjective correctness and fidelity to speaker intention. Their semantics are intentionalist, and Grice is one such theorist. Those more impressed by the directedness of language towards, or its appeal to its audience, its appellative or conative function, have given us pragmatic or practical theories of language, and their main criteria of validity are practical effectiveness or felicity or intersubjective correctness. Strawson, Austin, and the later Wittgenstein would number among these philosophers, but also to some extent Grice in his notion of conversational implicature. And by the way, there's plenty of scope for disagreements with what I'm saying. If you think I'm being dogmatic, you're probably right, but it's the only way I've found to carve a way through the welter of theories and movements that constitute the philosophy of language. But I haven't time to argue each point in detail. What links Frege, particularly to his successors in the designative tradition, including the Wittgenstein of the Tractatus, was that in privileging language's relationship to objects in the world, they took truth and objectivity to be what validated and indeed what gave meaning to language. Some of the difficulties arising from the simplistic referential or designative tradition theory that Frege inherited were not all words, even nouns, have obvious counterparts in the world. You only have to consider words like of and but, or didn't, or sake. Some words appear to name non-existent items, like Mrs. Malaprop, nobody, Othello, and tomorrow's dinner. And on the simple referential theory, co-referring terms, like Phosphorus and Hesperus, have the same meaning, both referring to the planet Venus. Yet to say that Hesperus is Phosphorus seems to tell us something about the world in a way that saying Venus is Venus doesn't. Frege began the process of improving the referential theory in a way that gave full or partial solutions to some of these and other problems, and also pointed the way to other philosophers to develop the work he started. Realizing that informative identity statements like Hesperus's phosphorus are not analytic but synthetic, that is, they tell us something about the world, he distinguished within meaning two concepts. First, that of reference or Bedeutung, the notion of meaning that preserved the truth-meaning relationship, and secondly, that of the sense or sin of the expression, the perspectival aspect through which its reference is identified, which Frege also considered the thought expressed by the expression. That not only solved the immediate problem of giving a meaning, sin, to Hesperus that was distinct from that of phosphorus, but was the basis of the philosophical distinction between the intentional and extensional uses and aspects of words, on which intentional, with an S, intentional logic is based. I'm not going further into intention now. It's a complicated subject that will take too long, though of immense importance in analytical philosophy. On substitutability of co-referring terms, I'll just give Frege's rule, that if substitution of terms in an expression preserves the truth value, salva veritate, the substituted term has the same reference. If the thought expressed remains the same, salva significatione, the substituted term has the same sense. Frege's struggle with language was motivated by his attempt to find a basis for mathematics in logic, and this drove him in search of the logical structure that he was convinced must underlie natural language. Donald Davidson, in his 1967 paper Truth and Meaning, wrote, "Philosophers have long been at the hard work of applying theory to ordinary language by the device of matching sentences in the vernacular with sentences for which they have a theory." Frege's massive contribution was to show how all, some, every, each, none, and associated pronouns, in some of their uses, could be tamed. For the first time, it was possible to dream of a formal semantics for a significant part of a natural language. This dream came true in a sharp way with the work of Tarski. End of quotation. But before getting on to Tarski, and indeed back to Davidson himself, Russell must be brought in. Russell, in the referential tradition, built on Frege's achievements, particularly his work on quantifiers, which we've just been talking about, to attack problems of representation left unsolved by Frege. Russell's theories of description brilliantly tidied up four outstanding problems, those of reference to non-existence, like Othello, and also to negative existentials, no one came, the intentional problem of the non-preservation of truth, of truth value, when substituting co-referring terms in reported speech and propositional attitudes, and the problem of the excluded middle, in such a sentence as, "The King of France is neither bald nor not bald." Russell rejected Meinong's ontologically extravagant ploy of according some form of existence or subsistence to the supposed reference of any term, including mythical beasts and contradictions like round squares. Instead, obsessed with the logic of the word "the" and pursuing the thesis of an actual grammar underlying the superficial grammar of ordinary language, Russell analysed the problem sentences containing non-generic singular terms, such as "the present King of France is bald," and he analysed these three sentences. Thus, at least one person is the present King of France, at most one person is at most one person is the present King of France, and third, there is nothing which is the present King of France and is not bald. In this case, because the first sentence is patently false, Russell could give a definitive truth value, false, to the original sentence, for which Frege would have simply, have lacked a truth value. The same type of analysis could be used to produce testable truth conditions that remove the other problems. And in answer to the objections that proper names were not susceptible of this kind of analysis, Russell replied that by treating proper names as abbreviated descriptions, they could be treated in the same way. Despite attacks by several philosophers, including Peter Strawson, Donnellan, Searle, and Kripke, Russell's analysis has been tremendously productive for analytical philosophy. Strawson's criticism that reference does not involve assertion, that a definite description does not entail, but only implies or presupposes the existence of the reference, is particularly significant for the philosophy of language because of its basis in the claim that expressions don't refer, only people refer. He says, mentioning or referring is not something an expression does. It is something that someone can use an expression to do. In Strawson's view, semantic analysis was not about what sentences really mean. It was a pragmatic analysis about the way we use language. And here we have the pragmatic term, enunciated by Strawson in the words, "There can be no semantics without pragmatics." Keith Donnellan criticised both Russell and Strawson for failing to recognise that referential expressions generally had either a primary referential use, where identifying the referent was the point, or an attributive use, where the main point was to say something about the referent, who or whatever it happened to be. However, his emphasis on the communicative intentions of the speaker put him very much in the Strawsonian camp of stressing the importance of context, an aspect of the holism of language to which Frege had drawn attention with his context principle. You may remember in Habermas's division of semantic theories, those giving prominence to the speaker-language relation concentrated on the expressive function and were intentionalist. Strawson, Donnellan and Grice were very much of this persuasion, with Grice's intentionalism as maybe the prime example. But to introduce Grice in this whirlwind tour, I'm first going to mention Austin, who may be considered the father of pragmatics. In his famous 1961 paper, Performative Utterances, Austin attacked the entrenched view that, as he put it, the sole business, the sole interesting business of any utterance, that is, of anything we say, is to be true or at least false. Thus he declared war on theories of meaning that equated semantic value with truth value. This was on the grounds that speech acts constitute a lot more than assertions or declarative statements. They include, for example, imperatives, interrogatives, optatives, and exclamations, not to mention expletives. However, his main exemplification of utterances that departed from the declarative model and defied analysis in terms of truth and falsehood was with performative utterances, what he called illocutionary speech acts, which functioned performatively. Expressions like "I promise," "I swear," and "I do" of the marriage ceremony. Expressions whose meaning is in the utterance construed as an act. Their validity isn't a question of truth or falsehood, but in whether the speech is successful or effective, and was judged by Austin in terms of what he called its felicity. Here you may have noticed we've crossed into another of Habermas's categories, that in which the audience language relation is of prime importance, in which social context and intersubjectivity are keys to the value of illocutionary utterances. I shan't go on to elaborate Austin's theory in terms, for example, of perlocutionary acts, but only say two things. First, it wasn't in the end altogether successful, because of the failure of Austin or any other philosopher to disentangle the illocutionary and declarative elements from many utterances which seem to contain both. "I hereby name this ship" certainly seems to have a truth value, and a witness who saw the crime and says in court, "I state that I saw nothing," may technically be telling the truth, since a positive truth value may actually be accorded to the illocutionary part of this sentence, though one that conflicts with the illocutionary and normative force of the statement as a whole. But secondly, Austin's impact on the referentially biased philosophy of language certainly enriched it and opened up avenues that others such as Grice were to follow. Grice was a linguistic pragmatist who straddled two of the Habermas divisions. His adherence to appellative semantics, the derivation or attribution of semantic value from audience effect, followed on from Austin's introduction of the notion of perlocutionary effect from certain utterances. These are utterances whose success or failure is in the effect they have, and examples are scaring, amusing, amazing. Grice distinguished between expressions having audience effect ad hoc in relation to the context of the utterance, and they're carrying the effect because of a history of use, as Medina says, through a long chain of similar speech acts with similar effects. Grice dubbed these two kinds of semantic effect conversational implicature and conventional implicature. I shan't say too much about implicature, as it was the subject of a recent Philsoc seminar, but I'd just remind you that of Grice's reference to the maxims that seem to regulate our communicative exchanges. He talks about maxims of quantity, relevance, quality, and manner, all operating within the cooperative principle, which states, "Make your conversational contribution such as is required at the stage at which it occurs by the accepted purpose or direction of the talk exchange in which you are engaged." It's through our implicit awareness of this principle and the maxims that implicature works. It's a normative thing. And if any Wittgensteinian bells are ringing, they probably should be, but I'll leave it to Peter to harmonise them. Oddly, perhaps, implicature bridges back from audience effect, Habermas's appellative function, to his semantic category of speaker intention. Does so through the distinction Grice pointed up between sentence meaning of what may be quite different, speaker meaning. For example, the speaker who exclaims, "That was a fine thing to say," means just the opposite of the word's literal meaning. Grice's semantic theory is extremely speaker-oriented. It leaves referential theories of meaning far behind, being thoroughly intentionalist, connecting with the external world mainly through the heads of the interlocutors. While still concerned with audience effect, it is audience effect as perceived by the speakers. Much of his theory is summed up in this quotation from his 1957 article, Meaning. "We may say that A meant something by X is roughly equivalent to A uttered X with the intention of inducing a belief by means of the recognition of this intention." Grice thus contextualizes his intentionalist semantics within human interactions, but doesn't neglect to give an explanation of how language retains a large degree of stability. He does this through the concept of timeless meaning, which has a Lockean ring to it, insofar as Locke, you may remember, claimed that it was only through long and familiar use that words can come to excite in men certain ideas so constantly and readily that they are apt to suppose a natural connection between them. Grice's timeless meaning derives from the conventions or expectations that have been established in the course of many repetitions of occasional use of language, as he calls it, in the same intentional way. And so he writes, "An utterer is held to convey what is normally conveyed or normally intended to be conveyed, and we require a good reason for accepting that a particular use diverges from this general usage." I'll now move rapidly on to the interpretive term. This may be considered a turn away from something held by Donnellan, namely that reference by an utterer is totally independent of his beliefs and wholly dependent on his communicative intentions. But this is problematic because, as Medina points out, what matters is not simply the speaker's reference, but how he or she manages to communicate his or her referential act to an interlocutor. What matters is joint reference or co-reference, the convergence of the referential acts of speaker and hearer in communicative exchanges. As he concludes, a theory of reference must involve nothing less than a full-blown theory of interpretation that can explain how mutual understanding can be achieved in communication. Interestingly, reference is back on the scene, with a partial return at least to the designative or empirical tradition. Two so-called neo-empiricists, W.B. Quine and Donald Davidson, presented interpretive theories of meaning. Both return to a number of peculiarly Freudian features of analysis, versions of a holistic approach to meaning, an extensional concept of objective truth in the correspondence between language and the world, an appreciation of the intentional concept of belief, and the distinction between natural language and, if not quite a logical grammar underlying natural language, at least the idea of a meta-language that can be used for the analysis and clarification of the natural or object language. Both rejected the Donnellan-type view of the independence of belief and reference. Understanding each other calls for an understanding of the beliefs associated with what we mean in our reference to things in the world. Quine brought this home in his attack on the distinction observed by Kant and many modern philosophers between analytic and synthetic truths. Truths justified purely on the basis of linguistic meaning, such as no bachelor is married, and truths justified by reference to the world, like John is a bachelor. Quine argues that understanding any expression both linguistic demands both linguistic and empirical knowledge. We can't understand rabbit, for example, without an empirically derived belief about the world, which itself depends upon some linguistic understanding of the concept of rabbit. What rabbit means and what a rabbit is are, for Quine, inextricably linked. So in order to identify the meanings expressed by words and also identify the beliefs expressed by statements, we need an interpretive methodology. Quine's methodology was illustrated by his technique of radical translation, in which the object or natural language was to be translated into the language of the interpreter. I can't go into all the complexities of his explanation and arguments for this, but only highlight some of his main assumptions or conclusions. One of these, dependent on his view of the holistic web of interdependent beliefs each of us holds, connected only at their periphery to the stimulation of the senses by the external world, led to his theory of the indeterminacy of translation and his contention that two translators could come up with incompatible translation manuals. This is allied to his inscrutability of reference, on the grounds that the reference of a word is less determined by facts than by the ontology built into the translation manual. From this follows the thesis that radical indeterminacy is a basic and unavoidable feature of language. On Quine's view, in the words of Medina, communication consists in connecting webs of belief, and it's therefore of the utmost importance that these webs overlap. Translation requires a mapping of beliefs from one web onto another. For Quine, the ordinary kind of translation that is supposed to take place in everyday communication is also indeterminate. Davidson largely accepted and then built on Quine's account with the concept of mapping overlaps and relations between the different idiolects, as he called them, of interlocutors. So he focused on assertions and relied on the Taskian monological account of truth. He believed it should be possible to arrive at or interpret a speaker's meaning in one's own idiolect, employing the principle of charity and its expectations that most people held and expressed true beliefs, and that there's a massive overlap between belief systems. A tremendous optimism was expressed by Davidson in his self-set task of contributing to a theory of truth and meaning along these lines. As, for example, in two brief quotations from his 1967 paper, Truth and Meaning. First, as long as ambiguity does not affect grammatical form and can be translated ambiguity for ambiguity, a truth definition will not tell us any lies. And secondly, he talks about the need to separate uncovering the logical grammar or form of sentences, which is in the province of a theory of meaning as I construe it, and the analysis of individual words or expressions. But he does conclude that paper with these words: it must be allowed that a staggering list of difficulties and conundrums remains. And after listing some of these very technical problems, he demands a comprehensive theory of meaning for a natural language must cope successfully with each of these problems. That is leaving Davidson, of course, tremendously underdetermined. And I don't think Marianne will forgive me, but I have to push on. A part of the Quine-Davidson legacy were a pair of linked problematic issues: meaning skepticism, stemming from the indeterminacy of translation, and because of the Quine-Davidson focus on one-to-one interaction between interlocutors, each with their own idiolects, a neglect of the wider social dimension of language. Because I've already really said enough, I'm only going to hint now at how subsequent philosophy of language dealt with these problems. First of all, because fortunately you'll be hearing about Wittgenstein from Peter, I'll do little more than wave his name in front of you and suggest that he resolved the skepticism problem by largely accepting the holistic views of language held by Quine and Davidson, but denying that these involved meaning skepticism, on the grounds of the determinacy given to real live utterances by the context in which they were made. And this, of course, was tied into his view of language as an activity, and a largely social activity, that provided the normative aspects necessary to give it stability. That slant on language didn't in itself, though it was largely consistent with, present the sociological turn I promised you. The sociological turn, which is very much an animating force in current philosophy of language, has been driven by a combination of, on the one hand, linguistics and literary theory dating back to Saussure at the turn of the 19th and 20th centuries, and continuing into the 1970s and 80s with figures like Roland Barthes, Foucault and Derrida, and on the other hand, of continental and American sociologists come philosophers like Pierre Bourdieu and Judith Butler, to name but two. Without going deeply into the sociology of language, as it may be termed, I just say that the emphasis of this school is very much on the interaction between language and society, drawing attention, for example, to the way in which language, as it has historically grown, can operate as an instrument of political or personal subjugation, but also of liberation, because it is likely implicitly to contain norms that cement a person's acceptance of their social or political status. But this is only one of the many complex themes it deals with, drawing on and disagreeing with much that's been said in non-sociological 20th century philosophy of language. And there I'm going to end. I've probably said too much and left out too much. I mean, what about Nietzsche, Chomsky, Searle, Putnam, Heidegger, Gadamer? What of compositionality, metaphor, hermeneutics, and the vexed question of whether language reflects or creates reality? Well, I would refer you to the reading list.
I told you I did well in asking Frank to set this up. That's fantastic. And we've got 15 minutes for questions now. Remember, we've got most of this afternoon for discussion. Frank has worked very hard on it, so be kind with your questions. I will follow Marion Gilman's lead, and I just note down the names of this stuff.
I chose just to ask for a question of clarification here. You say that Quine and Davidson are both in the justification tradition of truth values as criteria of meaning. Just in case anyone is confusing truth values and truth conditions,
As I understand it, and as William Frege said about, the truth conditions of a comparative statement are those that state of the world which make the comparative assertion true or false. And the truth value is the truth of, is the truthfulness or falsehood of the statement.
So the truth conditions plus context determine truth value.
Yeah.
And what Davidson believes is that the meaning of a sentence is captured by the conditions under which the sentence is true or false.
Yes.
So meaning equates to truth condition, not truth value. Is so. I don't think you did mean that, but it just does that much to make sense. It's important.
Yes, Frege, I think, treated truth conditions as the meaning of the sentence, because it's what made the sentence true and therefore gave it meaning. So if you say cat is on the map, what it means is what is the truth condition that the cat is on the map. And this ties in actually with Cartier, I think, who made the extremely fundamental point, I'm afraid to look at it, it's on the maritime, that P is true if P, which is something very much within language.
Oh,
well, I've got to put your...
P is true if and only if P.
Yes.
So the cat is on the mat, the sentence the cat is on the mat is true if and only if the cat is on the mat. And that may sound trivial, but it's not if you divide the truth conditions on the right-hand side from the structure of the sentence on the left-hand side plus axioms. And we can do this later if anyone's interested, and it's actually very easy to explain. But
I think Tarkin is also a link here between Frege and Russell, because Tarkin reflects Frege to a great extent, although rather more fundamental.
Well, I'm David from East Parsons.
And it's our business to add.
Foundation.
Well, Davidson is accused of not developing a theory of truth, but relying on an understanding of theory of truth, rather than grasping a lot. Yeah. And concentrate on the meaning. And Dummett, for example, says that you have to develop the truth in parallel. I think that's often something as far as you need to.
Another point of clarification in defense of my old tutor Paul Grice, actually. You said, I think, that Grice's timeless meaning could be compared with, associated with, the lock, long and familiar use, as a way of seeing how words manage to read things. But Locke was talking about an association which you build up over time.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think Grice is committed to that in talking timeless meaning. I think he just meant a meaning which did not depend on the specific time utterance of the word as context and so on, but ran it over time and associated with type rather than paper. And that's obviously right, that if you think of the meaning of the word hexagon, you don't have to see a great many hexagons and have them pointed out as hexagons in order to know that a six-sided figure is a hexagon. It's a conventional definition. And it's still timeless in that it doesn't depend on a specific use of hexagon to have that meaning.
Yeah, fine. Although I think hexagon is a pure example insofar as it's a returning thing. But I think Grice would also have applied to this other more ambiguous word. And I agree with what you said, because I still think there is an interesting parallel between in different which is from that you establish a convention where they continue to have the same meaning and make the point that you have to have justification to diverge from that meaning. In that, I see a parallel with law.
Well,
sure,
I'm just yes, Peter.
I'd like to try a question there. You talked earlier on about two traditions in this way. That seems to be the ability to correspond with the world. It's a gap actually. Are you treating two as correspond with four as something else? And also the word unity is being said in that.
Just on correspondence, Frege himself disavowed any correspondence theory of truth. And I think he more gave up the idea of developing a good theory of truth as such. So I use the word rather loosely when I was talking about correspondence between the world and assertions about the world. And I wasn't referring to a formal correspondence theory. As regards what I mean by union, all I can do is say that there are lots of different theories about it. And I try to defend it, different types of theories. Some relate meaning very closely with truth. Others say that truth is not relevant to any sense of truth or some sense of truth at all. I mean, the performance of utterances aren't just in terms of whether they're truth or not. Their meaning is a social meaning or contextual meaning. And so I don't think it's possible to give a single account of what meaning is, but to draw from all these theories the value that they contribute to our understanding of how we should use in different contexts.
In point 15 of your handbook, you say, nevertheless, Stein and Davidson position that this is a meaning
skepticism. Well, Stein particularly drew attention to the indeterminacy. And spectacularly, the dispatch of two translation manuals could be written by two different interpreters that were incompatible. By which he meant that in the interpretation of what somebody was telling to you, two different interpreters could in fact draw two different meanings out of what was being said. That
for both meaning skepticism and meaning skepticism.
Yes, skepticism that meaning could be determined for that, yes.
Well,
Simon was also skeptical about
whether the meaning
existed.
Didn't want to think of meaning as existing.
Well, that's what I recommend, really, because skepticism seems like a heavy word to use, but it's really, I wondered whether he meant more than that.
Yeah, but I think the two are so clear. I mean, if you go to meaning, or doesn't it is, you've got to think about skepticism about, and meaning skepticism just term applies to that and probably more.
Well, if you think there's no such thing as meaning, and you're saying you're very sure skepticism is no such thing as meaning.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. That's all I have in mind, yeah.
That's strange, shall we make a break for coffee and go we start getting 11:30 as well. But thank you very much again.